Thank you all for being here today. I need to reiterate, as I always do, I do not have a divinity degree. I'm not an ordained lay minister. I don't even have a bachelor's.
We don't care.
So what I have to say is wide open for discussion. as is common, why a lot of other denominations don't seem to care for our denomination. We have that backwoods nature of arguing, which makes us strong. Keeps people like me from becoming too way out there in left field. Wow. So I chose from the lectern today. I'm traditional. I choose from the lectern. I don't always agree, or I don't always have an understanding of why the powers that be chose the verses they chose for the lectionary. I read all four and I thought, oh boy, nothing really grabs me. One of the four was Psalms 23rd. We all have heard. We're familiar with that. The power and the majesty in that and the safety. And then I was left with the other three. Oh God. So finally, I chose to go with John chapter 10, verse 1 through 10, and they didn't even give me the full concept. They just went with 10 of the verses. What? What is that about? I'll read it here for you. So this is from the book of John, chapter 10, verses 1 through 10. And Jesus said, truly, truly, I say to you, who does not enter the sheepfold by the door, but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens, the sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name, and he leads them out. When he has brought all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him. And they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of strangers. This figure Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door to the sheep. All who come before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not heed them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and he will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy and have it abundantly. Yeah. Pulled out my books and did research. So this is published in the 1800s through mid-1900s. It's the standard when you go to Bible churches. It's the Oxford Annotated. It's quite an authority. This was published in 1993. It's called The Five Gospels, and a lot of people will string me up and hang me for this. It was written by the Jesus Seminar. It took them 25 years to compile. It's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the Gospel of Thomas. The Gospel of Thomas came from the Nag Hammadi, which was hidden in caves, not subject to eons of political fighting and killing and threatening. And it was found in 1945, and it was hidden by the authorities until one of the authorities allowed to look at it and view it, put it on the internet. And it was promptly published in 1993. In this book, The Five Gospels, 254 of the world's top biblical scholars, not all Christian, they're the top biblical scholars. Some names you may recognize as some ministers from TCU, you name it. They could be Catholic, Protestant, Islamic, Jewish, but they were the authorities. You know, they speak and write 27 different languages, and they know the entire history of the Synoptic Gospels, and what's real, what isn't, what's a fake, and what's a forgery, and they've seen the scriptures, they've seen the original text, they've done x-rays of the text that can't be opened. It took them 25 years They met in conjunction in conference. And after 25 years, going over Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and the Gospel of Thomas, which was from the Dead Sea Scrolls, they argued and fought and voted on what were Jesus' words. You can put all of the New Testament of what they absolutely agreed on in his words in one paragraph. That is in red in this book. If they thought maybe he said it, he could have said it, but maybe he didn't, but it's definitely when his thought, and it's a good chance he said it, it's pink. You can put what's pink on one full page. If it was something he did not say, but was within his thought and framework, it's gray. You can put what's gray in one page. The rest is black. And they say in here that black can be black for many things, but most likely was inserted by enemies of his thought. So, of course, you know, when I turn to John, book 10, guess what's in black? I'm going to preach. I can't lie. I can't lie about something that the definitive authorities say was not within his thought, that he didn't say, that might have even been inserted by his enemies. So I had to read. I had to research. But when I got to thinking about all the idea of shepherds and safekeeping, this has something in common with Psalms. It's talking about protection, safeguarding, you know, the shepherd, pastures. And I looked up what he's talking about is this stone, short stone wall, maybe so tall, whatever the size of the herd is, and stuffed in it are sticks that have thorns, and there's one little doorway, and that's where they can come in and go out, and that's where the shepherd guards. We're going to find out later there's a lot of symbolism in that. So, I thought, man, it sounds like, you know, in Psalms and in this verse, there's a lot of room for failure. There's wanting protection, wanting safety, wanting guarding. And I thought, man, you know, I thought of all the historical characters I know that would have been in that state of absolute fear, standing up for, you know, what they wanted to stand up for, or absolute failure. My first thought came to Adam. Whether we take it literally or not, there is the allegory, the story of Adam eating of the tree of knowledge. He becomes self-aware, and at that point, he's ashamed. At that point, he is separate from God. And at that point, he is expelled from the garden. Tanya's been talking about gardens. Wow, lest we fail. Separated from God in his own self-awareness and was ashamed of who he was. I read an excerpt once where John Steinbeck, you know, the author of The Grapes of Wrath, East of Eden, wrote a letter to his son, and in the letter he's talking about the big mistake that Adam made was that he became knowledgeable. He thought he should be something more. That he was embarrassed and ashamed. He looked around, he saw these animals and this whole glory, and he's just pale and naked. And he didn't realize the wonder that he was from dirt. You know, I'm from Kansas and Oklahoma, man. We're rich, moist dirt. Smells so good at night. And without that, we don't exist. If you don't have clean, moist dirt, there is no life at all. Adam didn't know that. That was the big mistake. Wanting to be something more than that. Not realizing the wonder and the magic in that. Lest we separate from God, lest we fail. And I thought again, Joan of Arc. Holy cow. What was she, 17 when she had the visions? A 17-year-old girl. And she goes and tells the visions to the local magistrate that she's supposed to go talk to King Charles of France, and she's supposed to motivate him to go end and win this 100 years war with England. And they think, what the heck? The magistrate, along with the local priests, they see some proof in this miracle. She's having visions. She goes and talks to the king. And his bishop quizzes her, says, yeah, she's the real deal. She's having visions. So she suits up. They make her armor. She leads them in the battle at 17, leads them into battles at 18. This is brutal hand-to-hand combat that would make Navy SEALs run off and scream. It's a little girl, you know, 17, 18. Well, at 19, she gets sent on a special envoy mission to Burgundy. It's a trap. Those in Burgundy are under siege, so they turn her over to the English. And the English keep her as a hostage, but King Charles doesn't want her back. He's already winning his battles. He has no use for her. Then the Roman Catholic Church, the Church, the Orthodox papacy, questions her. And they interrogate her for days, for weeks. The interrogators keep them back saying, no, she's the real deal. She's having visions. The Pope makes a deal with the current king, and at 19, they burn her at the stake. Wow, that's a great church for you, huh? They burn to death alive a 19-year-old girl. Wow, lest we fail. Failure. I can't come tell you guys this. Supposed to motivate you. I mean, right now there's failure all around us. There are institutions that are claiming to be for Christ, the Word of Christ, by Christ, Christian. And they are no different than powers that be that have always been. And I'm supposed to read this from John, the five Gospels, you know, say, no, it's not the real deal. Then I'm like, wait a minute. I remember conversations I had with my dad, and I pull out all the books, because I got all of his books when he passed. And I start looking up Gnostics, the different sects of Gnostics. I pull out my Gnostic Gospels. Here's what I found out. Some of what's black in here got snuck through. They weren't enemies of Christ's thought. They snuck through mystic concepts and code through some of the powers that be that were imperial that didn't want that kind of information getting through. Because those that were imperial were kind of blind to the code, obvious mystic code that's going on. None of that was much of an issue until the Council of Nicaea. Constantine, you have to remember there were four major civil wars from the time of Jesus' death into the early 100s. And one of these civil wars, Constantine, the Emperor Constantine, wins. And contrary to what popular belief is, he did not see a cross. He saw the Kyros sign, the first two letters in the Greek word for Christ, the Chi and the Hro. And his soldiers, being the good legionaries they were, not to bring bad luck, put that image on their shields. He won the battle. He united the empire. You've got to know what was going on historically. By that time, it's estimated that 1/6 to 1/10 of his legionaries had already converted to Christianity, which was okay. If you were a legionnaire, you were welcome to practice whatever religion you wanted to practice, as long as you were there to fight and follow orders and do what you're supposed to do. But 1/6 to 1/10 of his legion? You better do something about that. You can't execute them. You lose 1/6 to 1/10 of your forces. In his wisdom, he makes Christianity the official Roman religion. He orders the Council of Nicaea, 329 AD, I believe. And in that council, without saying anything, because the power of emperors and massive generals is what they don't say, the bishops, the area, kind of are put under house arrest. It's not house arrest, no, but it's house arrest. And they have to do the Roman thing. They have to come up with official books. Because until then, Christianity met in homes and was organized by women. And there were all kinds of sects with varying degrees of difference of opinion that were valid. They argue. The lead bishop, just out of the whim, decides, well, the four directions, northeast, southwest, four is the right number, the four elements, we're going to have four gospels. So they argue for four gospels. This is in 329 AD. In 180 AD, earlier, when the Gnostics were being pushed out by other sects of Christianity and Judaism, Messianic Judaism, there was a certain bishop that was in Syria. His name was Irenaeus. And Irenaeus did not like the Gnostics, but he really liked their gospel, which had not been accepted until then. Because in their gospel, it defines the both humanity and the otherworldliness of the Christ and of Jesus as the human. He likes it. He puts his power, he puts his influence behind it, and that book is adopted as one of the true gospels. It becomes truth. It becomes the real deal. So by the time 324 rolls around, even though the Gnostics are being pushed out, will be pushed out, will be hunted like dogs and killed worse than the Christians ever were, the Gospel of John gets put in. It's full of code. My dad loved that book. We'll get into that. So when you rethink about John 1 through 10, he's talking about the sheep. He's talking about the shepherd. The sheep knows the shepherd's voice. He's talking about the doorway to get into the sheepfold. I looked up the language. I reverse translated from English to German to Latin to Hebrew to Aramaic. And you really get down to it in Aramaic. Holy cow. Then I looked up what the symbols are within Gnosticism. Wow. Here we go. I first wanted to see how many times the theme of protection is referenced in the Bible. Defense, protection, guarding. Only 365 times. Huh? Why am I having to preach on John? Only 365 times. I thought it would be the top choice, right? You want the Bible, you want protection, you go to God for protection, for guidance, blah, blah, blah. No, only 365 times. You know what's talked about the most in the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament together? The poor and the destitute. 3,000 times. 3,000 times the poor and the destitute are referenced. Next in that comes love and faith and sin. Wow. But the poor and the destitute, 3,000 times. So why are we talking about protection and following the shepherd? And well, here we go. You got to understand some things. Sin, in the New Testament Greek, really means missing the mark. Sin, in Aramaic, really means to stumble. They're talking about a path. Huh. Love, in both the Aramaic and the New Testament Greek, refer to agape. That's the Greek word agape. They're talking about unconditional platonic love. Unconditional, baby. And faith, this was really interesting. Faith isn't a noun, it's a verb. That's odd. And the Aramaic, I won't even try to say it. It's associated, it really means the dedication of a nursing mother. Wait a minute. We're talking about a path, missing the mark or stumbling. We're aiming for love and faith. And faith meaning the dedication of a nursing mother. And love being unconditional. That and doing this for the poor and the destitute. That's why there would be a sheepfold. That's why there would be sheep. That's why there'd be a shepherd. There's a purpose for that. And then I look at the meaning, the symbolism within Gnosticism for sheep and what those words really translate to. That sheepfold is the kingdom of God. And some of the Gnostics are talking about a realm beyond this realm where the one true God monad, who has allowed Yahweh, the fake God, the jealous, the vengeful God, to make earth and think he's the real God, you can pass through a realm. Most Gnostics are talking about the here and now, the kingdom of heaven. Like the Chinese sages of old that were told to be able to walk around, and they were in a place where the tiger had no place to place its claws. That eternal now, where death has no grip. So we're talking about sheep in a sheepfold, which is the kingdom of heaven, and the doorway, the doorkeeper. They believe the Christos is the doorkeeper to other realms. And a quite large number believe that he was the doorkeeper to this realm. We go from a three-dimensional that we're aware of to where, if we practice unconditional love with the behavior of a nursing mother to the poor and the destitute, we are transformed into a fourth-dimensional existence where past, present, and future all exist at once. We are as that place that Lao Tzu disguises the sage saying he's in a place where the tiger cannot place its claws. Jesus refers to it as the kingdom of heaven. If you reread a lot of those stories, the allegories, they'll begin to make sense. I want to add that when I looked up the symbolism of sheep within the allegories and the symbols of Gnosticism, it means child. So we are children going through the Christos into the kingdom of heaven that requires agape, unconditional love, to get to that. And there is one doorway. Lots of arguing on that, lots of debate. The Gnostics lost out, but they slipped it through. It got in there. I'm going to read it now, not with fancy wording, but very plain wording. Be advised, this is pretty strong. When they rewrote this, they rewrote it how those 204 people believed it would have been said. I swear to God, anyone who does not enter the sheep pen through the gate but climbs in some other way is nothing but a thief and a robber. But the one who comes through the gate is the shepherd. The gatekeeper lets him in. The sheep recognize his voice. He calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he was driven out, the last of his own sheep, he walks in front of them, and the sheep follow him because they know his voice. They would never follow a stranger, but would run away from him since they don't know the voice of strangers. Jesus used this figure of speech with them, but they didn't understand what he was talking about. Jesus went on to say, "As God is my witness, I am that gate for the sheep. All who come before me are nothing but thieves and robbers, but the sheep haven't paid any attention to them. I am the gate. Who comes ever in through me will be safe, will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and slaughter and lay waste. I came so they can have life and have it to the full." When he talks about walking ahead of the sheep, the term, something that walks forward, that's the root meaning to the Aramaic word talia. It means young or old servant. So we are children of God on that path to the eternal now, and we are supposed to be servants. We're being taught how to be shepherds. That's what a child of God means. We're not dumb sheep like cattle. They snuck it through. You don't need a priest. You don't need an intermediary. You don't need somebody to pray for you so you can get into heaven. the kingdom of heaven is here. And I started thinking about that. I'm going to read from you from the beginning of John. And once again, it's in black. And once again, it is in very obvious mystic language. In the beginning was the Word. In Greek, word is logos. In Aramaic, it means light, pure light. It's the creative force in the universe, stars, galaxies. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. You've got a Zen paradox. The creative force, the light, was God, but it is also with God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was not made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. There was a man sent forth from God whose name was John. He came for testimony, to bear witness to the light, that all might believe through him. He was not the light, but he came to bear witness to the light. That would have been Jesus' cousin John, John the Baptist. The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world. He was in the world, and the world was made through him, yet the world knew him not. He came to his own home, and his own people received him not. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of men, but of God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. That's a play on words on purpose. Snuck through. The Bishop Irenaeus didn't see it. He's too busy. Yeah, Jesus became flesh and dwelt among us. Yeah. The light became flesh and dwelt among us. Jesus even says that in some of his parting words. Lo, I'm with you always. I'm the light that's within you. Now let's talk about those who are that light, who in some circumstances may have failed, but they are still attached to that light. And death cannot grab them. Physically, sure. Spiritually, they're in that fourth dimension, past, present, future. You know that moment when the shadow's just right on the leaves and they're sparkling on the ground? When the clock stops. When someone grabs your hand and says, I love you. When someone comes up and says, hey, can I take care of that for you? When someone is just there, unconditionally. Lest we fail to know, to see, to hear, to feel the love of one another, the love of the Christos. I want to talk to you about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He was a Lutheran minister, World War II, that was German. Brilliant theologian. Had all the wealth and the money and the power to leave. He did leave Germany. Was over here and thought, what am I doing? I need to get back there. I need to be the light. He helped countless Jews escape. Preached from the pulpit on the atrocities and the evil. They put him in jail. This is not jail here, which is bad enough. This is Nazi Germany jail. For a year and a half, they tortured him. A year and a half. And the day they hung him, his last words were recorded. His last words were, just before the gallows fell, his body wiggled, neck snapped. This is the end. For me, the beginning of life. They killed with him that day the admiral and the general of Nazi intelligence. They too had been in on this for a year and a half with Dietrich Bonhoeffer, helping hide Jews and get them out and get them to escape. The tiger had no place to place its claws. They were in the eternal now. I want to talk to you about Desmond Doss. Some of you who are veterans may know about Desmond Doss. Little tiny skinny kid, wanted to serve his nation in World War II, was a conscientious objector. He was a Seventh-day Adventist. They not only laughed him at boot camp, they beat the you-know-what out of him. They did everything to get him to quit, ostracized him, made fun of him, daily beat him. He got into battle. He refused to carry any weapon. By that time, they began to respect him. They had no power, no idea the power he was going to carry. They go to the Battle of Okinawa, this big battle where they've got to go up this 400-foot cliff and attack the Japanese that are the last stronghold up there. 12-hour battle that night. They're slaughtered. Forget it. The Japanese are embedded. They're fighting to the last man. They're getting slaughtered. Desmond got the Medal of Honor because over that 12 hours with no gun, he got 85 people out and down a 400-foot cliff by himself. And that was just so, it wouldn't seem so impossible. The troops with him said he got down 185 men through that hell. Imagine how he felt, man. All that chaos going on, all the killers, all the blood, the corpses, the body, the fear, the smell. Wow, lest we fail. I'm going to bring it more home. I got personal stories. You know, I was in the Navy for 6 years. My last 2 years, I was in the Philippines. It was a place of extreme beauty and purity, and then it could be a place of just might meets right. It could be brutal. It was harsh. 0.5% of the population there owns all capital, even schools. You got a smaller percentage that's middle class. Everybody else is dirt. Poor. I mean dirt on the floors. And the smell. Can't get it out of the city. So you just kind of get used to it. And I was drinking one night with a buddy. We were out at a bar. And I said, you know, what's the kindest thing you've ever done? And he started to tear up. Oh, this is going to be good. So all of us gather in and we're listening. He said, well, a couple of months ago, I was out with a hostess. And she'd taken me to her house. And, you know, we did the deal. And I woke up in the middle of the night, we're on her bed, and I look over and I think it's a dog in the dog bed. And it's a little boy. So I wake up and I take the little boy and I put him on the bed with his mother. I try to fit on the dog bed, but I can't. So I lay on the floor. And I wake up in the morning just covered with flea bites. We're in tears. Wow. Lest we fail. Lest we not remember who we are. I have another story to share. I used to do home health to a patient. It was only for about 3 weeks in the poorest area of San Diego called City Heights. I swear to God, for 3 miles by 3 miles, there is no bank. There are no ATM machines. There are 72 different languages spoken in that area. And I would do home health visits for Kaiser. For 3 weeks, 3 days a week, I went to a home of a man that was below average IQ, massive health problems, living off of the state and federal because he just wasn't going to be able to do anything else. And he had an ailment where he was probably going to be dead in 6 months. And when I went in there, I had to wear short pants and white socks with white shoes and keep my nursing supplies in my backpack because there were fleas and cockroaches everywhere. Nothing could be done about it. And this man had no money. Every time I went in, He offered me his Kool-Aid. It was off-brand Kool-Aid from Dollar General. I didn't want to drink it. I certainly didn't want to take his Kool-Aid. That's all he had. But I would sit down and drink a small Dixie cup of Kool-Aid. Man, lest we fail. What a soul. I did night shifts, some at a skilled nursing facility, and there was one lady that just smelled. She was way overweight, had no legs, no family, no friends, all by herself, warehouse, we used to call it. But she would do her best to gussy herself up every day, and I worked nights. And she remembered my name, although I didn't work there much, and I always saw her attending to other patients, caring for them, loving them. And I would come in, she'd remember something I'd said from, you know, 2.5 months ago. And she'd ask how I was doing. She really meant it. She wanted to know. A very mending, healing lady to be with. But look at her life, you know. You'd say she's a failure, lest we fail. No. Now, I'm sure that some of you, no, I'm sure that all of you have had experiences like that. I'm sure that all of you have had massive failures too, where you were not asking out for protection, and in the midst of this failing, you were struggling to remember who you are, to remember that light in you. I know people here, man. I know big, giant people here that struggle with extreme pain. I know very competent people here who struggle to balance between a corporate that wants to make people small and they stand up and they're champions for them. I know people that have struggled with their own personal problems to still be stalwarts of the society and love and care for people that can't afford it. I myself, you know, came here with all these great ideas of what it was going to be like, and my dad dies. I do his hospice, and my mom dies, and then my other mom dies. And, you know, I want to get a degree. I want to live in a house in the mountains. They're beautiful. They burn up. And the two relationships that I have over all these years, they fail. I was joking earlier. I'm low status, high value. You know, I'm a failure. But lest we fail, remember who we are. And I just want you to know, when I come into church, I recharge. It's the love that I feel here. And that is so important. The Christos is here. The light is here. And I'm reminded of that. Lest we fail to remember who we are, to remember what we are, to remember what our mission is. Lest we fail. As a group, we will not fail. We pick each other up. That's the beauty of it. Amen.